welcome everyone to this afternoon session of Marxism 2019. The topic for discussion will be, can the American Democrats be reformed? Just in case anyone was thinking of the Australian Democrats, then it's definitely not the question at hand. Our speaker today is American guest speaker, Justin Akers-Chacon. He's a professor of Chicano studies. He lives in San Diego, which is near the American-Mexican border. People probably will have seen him speaking on a few associated topics over the course of the conference so far. He's assured me that he is a fallen Democrat. So he was once a Democrat and is now no longer. Now he's a proud revolutionary socialist. And he'll be giving... well done. So he'll be speaking for about half an hour. I encourage people to kind of write down your thoughts, questions, queries, points for debate. We'll leave them till after he's finished talking for the discussion, and then we'll have over an hour or so to engage in all of that. So please make Justin welcome.
I like to start with drama. Okay, good evening, everyone. Yes, I'd like to start off by saying it's true, I am a fallen Democrat, capital D Democrat. I'm still a small D Democrat. It was many years ago. It was in the early 90s. I think my story parallels with a good number of people who entered the socialist left, through their experience in the Democratic Party. I was come from a working class family who didn't have health care, which is the experience of many people in the U.S. working class. And in 1992, Bill Clinton, Democrat, ran on a campaign of universal health care, and that was the entry point for me. I wanted health care. I didn't get it. So I decided that I'd probably have a better chance of becoming a socialist, which I still believe. So let me start by saying there has been a significant growth of the left in the United States. Since the election of Trump and, you know, the glaring failure of the Democratic Party leadership to present an alternative, social polarization has intensified to the point of chasm, and disgust, distrust, and disaffection have reached a magnitude unforeseen in a generation. This has led to a rapid and significant growth in the U.S., like I said, of the left and also of the far right. Although the latter, the far right, has always been part of the U.S. landscape. Talk a little bit more about that later. Support for socialism has been incrementally growing over the last several years and really expanded dramatically after the election of Trump and the Sanders campaign, of course, which I'll talk about. The breakthrough is most clearly reflected in the growth of an organization called the Democratic Socialists of America, which increased in size from 7,000 members in early 2016 to nearly 60,000 members today. So if you're counting, I think that's about 2.5, 3 years. The backdrop of this, I want to say, is a deep crisis in society, U.S. society. Especially for working class people. Despite what our TV programs may portray, the U.S. is the most socioeconomically unequal country of the rich countries. Since the recovery of the international crisis from 2009 to 2013, 95% of all economic gain has gone to the top 1%. The share of national income taken by the top 1% of adults in 2014 was nearly twice the amount as the bottom 50% of the population. In 2017, a study found that the three richest people from the U.S., hold more wealth than the bottom 50%. The income of the bottom 90% of the U.S. population has fallen almost every single year over the past 25 years. 20% of the U.S. population, about 64 million people, live in poverty. 40 million at right below the poverty level, 18.5 million in deep poverty, and about 5.3 million people that live in what's called absolute poverty. An additional 40% of the population, about 132 million people, are perched on the edge of economic insecurity, in other words, right above the poverty line, saying that they would be unable to cover an unexpected $400 expense, such as a medical emergency. On the other hand, corporate profits have doubled from $788 billion in 2002 to $2.1 trillion in 2015. The top 1% controls 42% of the nation's private wealth, which adds up to about $35 trillion. The U.S. has over a quarter of the world's 2,208 billionaires, and it also has a quarter of the world's prisoners. About 2.2 million people in the U.S. are in jail, prison, or in some kind of correctional facility. So that's a little bit of the backdrop. I also want to talk about social movements that have had an impact since the 2007-2011 economic crisis. Of course, the Arab Spring influenced the rise of the Occupy movement, which spread quickly across the U.S. and was broadly supported. Majorities, polls show the majority of working class people identified with the ideals, the 1% versus the 99%. The Black Lives Matter movement, which directly confronted and resisted the systematic racist violence woven into the U.S. state specifically against African American people. And of course, since the election of Trump, a kind of a visceral and active opposition, an episodic opposition that has expressed itself to almost everything that he has done, that his administration has done. Not a movement, but the 2016 Sanders campaign was both buoyed by these movements and affected the movements themselves. And the campaign helped project basic socialist ideas to millions of people in a way that, you know, it hadn't been possible before. These factors have contributed to the formation of what we call the new socialist movement. The first revival of socialist ideas, broad socialist ideas, since the late 60s, early 70s. And currently it's coinciding with the rise, a significant rise of class struggle in the United States. The largest strike wave in total numbers in several decades is taking place in the U.S., primarily led by teachers. A central question within this new socialist movement is that of the relationship to the Democratic Party. To work within it, to make it a socialist or labor party, or to maintain independence of it as an irredeemably capitalist party. This is not a new question in U.S. politics. I was thinking of a list to go through, but it became too long. Through the centuries. This has faced the movements from the Knights of Labor, Socialist Party, Communist Party, anti-war movement, civil rights movement, Rainbow Coalition, the anti-war movement, the immigrant rights movement. So let me talk a little bit about the Democratic Party. And I want to start by saying that the United States is not a democracy. And the Democratic Party is not democratic. The U.S. is not a democratic society in any true sense of the word. It can be it can be more accurately described as an oligarchy. A comprehensive Princeton study done a few years ago of the U.S. political system that looked at over the last 20 years of policy outcomes showed that regardless of which party is in power, policy that is passed into law aligns most closely with the views of the top 10% of the wealthiest in society, even when this cuts against the majority of the rest of public opinion. So in other words, regardless of who's in power, regardless, you know, of what time over the last 20 years, policy has tended to align closely with what the wealthy want. This was done by two Princeton scholars. They concluded that, quote, the preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact upon public policy. And, you know, put it in other terms, who controls politics? 400 of the richest families in the U.S. provided about half of all funding to the 2016 presidential candidates. And the functioning of the capitalist two-party system actually depends on voter suppression, both direct through disenfranchisement, the act of depriving people of the right to vote, and of course indirect through alienation, which affects a lot of people. Typically, 60% of those eligible, those who are eligible registered voters turn out for presidential elections, and 40% of those eligible turn out for midterms. And to give you a scale of the size, in 2012, 24% of eligible people did not even register to vote. So during the 2012 midterm election, 51 million people who were eligible to vote didn't even register. Slavery-era structures, such as the Electoral College, which I won't go into trying to explain to you because I still can't really fully understand it myself, except to say that it's a slave-era institution that ensures that the popular vote does not determine the presidency. The Senate, which is concentrated power in the upper house of our Congress, is based on representation, two senators per state, regardless of the population. So we have a state called Wyoming, which has about 500,000 people, and they get two senators, and we have a state called California, which has 40 million people, and they get two senators, to give you a sense of how that works. Between 6 to 7 million people, disproportionately black and brown people, are disenfranchised each election cycle due to archaic and segregation-era felon exclusion. So people who, in many states, cannot vote once they're charged with a felony, even if they do their time. To give you an extent of the significance of that, the 6 to 7 million people, typically the margin of error or victory in federal elections is far less than that 6 to 7 million people. It's usually fairly small. Of only 3 of the last 7 elected presidents won over 50% of the eligible vote, and 2 of the last 3 presidents actually lost the popular vote. Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes than Trump. In the 2000 election, Al Gore got at least 500,000 more votes than George Bush. The Republican Party wages an incessant war to exclude, disqualify, gerrymander, and otherwise minimize voter eligibility and participation. That's one side of it. On the other hand, the Democratic Party has fought vigorously to prevent the emergence of a left, especially a socialist left, either within or outside of its ranks. During the 2000 election, we had an independent candidate named Ralph Nader, and some of us had campaigned to support a genuinely left-wing campaign against the two other candidates, and the Democratic Party spent more time trying to keep Ralph Nader off the ballot than they did actually campaigning against the Republican Party. So in other words, the U.S. ruling class in the U.S. historically, it is normal for the under-functioning of democracy for it to persist in its current form. Its successful ability to demobilize and co-opt social movements, the Democratic Party, reflects in its contradictory character today. It is a top-down capitalist non-reformist party, in its essence, that is upheld by a significant reformist, reform-minded, and reform-hopeful base. For example, the Communist Party-led rise of the Congress of Industrial Organizations and Industrial Unionism in the 1930s was incorporated in such a way that the party and left-wing unions were crushed by the Democratic Party, which led much of the McCarthyist attack on socialists and communists. Yet today, most unions continue to uphold the party's pillars to mobilize to support the party's candidates. And even today, the party presents itself as the Party of Labor. The Civil Rights Movement was opposed by the Democratic Party establishment and was forced to make concessions as the party in power in the face of broad social movements in the 1960s and 70s. But it also did its best to limit the extent of the Reconstruction, to water down legislation against segregation and other reforms. The party worked to demobilize the movement by incorporating its most conservative elements while attacking the radicals. Party leaders, including former civil rights activists in its city and state level, then went on to preside over the decimation of black and Latino barrios and ghettos through systematic cuts in social spending and downsizing of welfare, affirmative action, education, and other social programs. These were desired by the Republican Party, but it took the Democratic Party to be able to push them through without stoking further opposition from civil rights groups. Yet the party claims today to carry the mantle of the Party of Civil Rights. The last of many examples I'll give is the party oversaw the implementation of the worst elements of immigration repression, including presiding over the mass deportation of millions of Mexicans in the 1950s, which contributed to the decimation of unions that organized black and brown people. The Democratic Party presided over the building of the modern border wall, presided in 1996 over the exclude even legal immigrants, so undocumented immigrants are excluded, but in 1996, Democrats presided over the exclusion of legal immigrants from most welfare services. They oversaw the largest expansion of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, the largest wave of mass deportation in history, which has been conducted in the United States since the mid-1990s. They introduced family detention, which Trump then took to the next level. Nevertheless, the party was able to sell itself as the party of legalization after the largest uprising of the working class in modern history in 2006, when immigrants took to the streets across the country in the millions to demand legalization and equal rights. This movement was then co-opted by the Democratic Party, which in 2006, its representatives in the social movement said, "Today we march, but tomorrow we vote." That was the slogan that they brought into the movement. Our slogan was "Amnesty Now," "Amnestia Ahora," and they shut us out. We didn't have the numbers. And so this "Today we march, tomorrow we vote" led to a significant voter outturn in 2006 and 2008. 2006 swept the Republicans out of the House of Representatives, and 2008 swept them out of the Senate and brought the Democratic President Barack Obama into power. In 2008, the Democrats held a supermajority, which is a very rare thing in the United States, in which one party controls majority of, they have the presidency and they control the majority of Congress. They have what's called an opposition-proof majority to pass any piece of legislation so long as they can all agree on it. And even though they had that, they could have passed legalization without one single Republican vote needed, they decided not to do it. Yet they still tout themselves as the party of immigrant rights. Okay, so there is a tendency to refer to the Democratic Party in the U.S. amongst the left as the graveyard of social movements because of their highly developed capacity to co-opt and demobilize. The Democratic Party is the oldest, longest-standing capitalist political party in world history. The Republican Party is the second. With age, as they say, comes wisdom, as well as firmed muscles, finely honed and time-tested skill and coordination, and vast interconnected organs and a deep, wide toolbox, all to maintain power. Capitalists use their parties through the state to preserve and further promote their class interests. In fact, the U.S. party preference amongst the capitalist class is very fluid in the United States, depending on the circumstances. Through their class organizations, trade associations, and other groupings, there are sectors that favor Republicans consistently, such as the oil and gas, and sectors that favor Democrats consistently, such as like Google, the tech industry. Many capitalists, though, will actually fund both parties at the same time, or shift from one party to the next, depending on what is happening politically, especially within the working class. So, for instance, after the dramatic opposition to the Iraq War in 2003, and after the discrediting of the Bush administration, Wall Street and many other sectors of capital shifted their money behind Barack Obama. Say president's names all day. So I don't want to get too deep into this, but I want to give an overview of how the party's actually structured. And I had to study this a lot because it's very difficult to disentangle. The Democratic Party functions to serve the capitalist class at all levels of government, which is reflected in how it organizes. It is not a political party in the traditional sense, with a membership base that allows for access, interaction, and participation at all levels of leadership selection, platform development, and accountability. Rather, it's a fundraising and campaign finance allocation system, which in which coalitions are formed around candidates at all levels of government. So they have cool names like the Democratic National Committee, which is kind of the top of the hierarchy, and then for each level of government they have these committees like the Democratic Senatorial Committee, the Democratic Congressional Committee, all the way down to the local committees and clubs at the city level. These bodies are the fundraising conduits. They're connected through donor groups, and they are controlled by elected party officials and appointees. So the Democratic Governor's Committee will be the governors of the Democratic-controlled states, and they organize themselves, and they basically, through this committee, raise funds to fund gubernatorial campaigns. So just to point out, only at the local level, really, do unions have much influence over Democratic Party structures. Because at the local level, they can raise money that can have an impact in terms of how much access they get. But in reality, unions are very marginal in terms of their influence within the Democratic Party. And working class people as a whole even though they make up the majority of the voters, they have very little organizational expression at any level. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the 2008—let me start by saying, to give you the scale of how much money cycles through our election system, according to this group, the Center for Responsive Politics, the 2018 congressional election cost $5.2 billion. That's how much money was cycled through the campaigns. And this is in a non-presidential year. So it'll probably eclipse $6 or $7 billion next year. 9/10 of that money comes from rich people through a highly gamed electoral rules system, which I will not try to explain, except to say that there are varieties of ways in which rich people as individuals, as groups of individuals, can raise and allocate money in ways that support candidates in different ways, and in many cases can raise money without even having their names revealed in terms of where their money's coming from. Besides direct funding through donors, the party is firmly linked to the state, buffeted by concentric rings of power and patronage dependent on ideological adhesion, including bureaucratic allegiances through aligned official staffs, appointees, etc. Since the capitalists control the privatized media, or the private media in the U.S., there are democratic wings of the media, which will close out any real left voices, and of course I'm sure you've heard of Fox News there, and others, there are right-wing media, farther right-wing media. But it's important to point out that the Democratic Party-aligned media is actually blocks out the left more than the right-wing media. I get called somewhat frequently by the right-wing media because they want to bring me on their shows to talk about things because they want to get me, you know. They want to have gotcha moments. But the left wing, I mean, excuse me, the liberal democratic wing will never bring people on the left onto their program. Candidates from the party, from the city to the federal level, are carefully managed choices vetted by these leadership structures in accordance with the particular objectives or leanings of wealthy donors, whose money pays for the salary of staffers, party offices, provides media access, and determines how much money they get in terms of fundraising. While there are liberal and conservative party wings, these reflect the cross-class alignments of the locales, which are in turn reflexive of the donors. Statewide and municipal party structures are smaller replicas. So in other words, it just starts one way and reproduces itself all the way down. Furthermore, the selection process of candidates within the Democratic Party is complicated by the undemocratic and labyrinthine primary rules and regulations. So we have 50 states in the United States, and we have 50 different sets of rules, all of which are designed to exclude left. Within the Democratic Party primary structures, all of which are designed to exclude people from the left. So, for instance, we have what's called this in the Democratic Party, we have the superdelegate system, in which party officials, like in California, for instance, if you're in the party as an elected official, you're automatically a delegate in the primary voting selection process. And so they pack these bodies that choose the candidates who will actually run for the Democratic Party, and they pack them with these people who are already officials of the party out of concern that if too much democracy breaks out and these delegates decide to vote for somebody who's not the party preference, then these superdelegates will overrule them. They also have party loyalty clauses, like in New York, that basically say that if you're not a party member, but you want to vote for a Democratic Party candidate, you cannot vote. And if you are a party member, you have to have a membership going back at least 1 year. So every state has some kind of way of knocking out, or excluding people. The party is big tent only so much as there is a consistently liberal, there are consistently liberal-minded individuals, which usually are products of local, locales, who operate at the margins of the party or try to push into the center during times of political ferment, or working class or social movement leaders like the Communist Party or civil rights groups in the 60s and 70s who believe that they can sort of muster the power of the social movement into the center, into the party and transform it from within. While the party has certainly swung leftwards at certain junctures of history and on certain social issues, including now, it has never deviated from the primary interests of the ruling class at any given point in time, and always dedicates itself to channeling those efforts back into voting for the party representatives, and always preserving the legitimacy of capitalism. I don't know if any of you saw when Nancy Pelosi was at a town hall meeting. Sometimes they accidentally let people in who aren't pre-selected into these town hall meetings, a young man asked, criticized capitalism, and it turns out he was from the Democratic Socialists, and Nancy Pelosi said, "Well, we're a capitalist party," she said it very confidently, So getting towards the conclusion here, even if revolutionary socialists were able to lay hold of party positions, capitalists would close ranks to take whatever measures necessary to make it untenable. We already saw this with the Bernie Sanders campaign, in which this outbreak of Democratic sentiment to vote for Bernie Sanders was stifled, including through overt corrupt ways. That's a tip of the iceberg of what capitalists would do if real socialists came to power, in terms of economic sabotage and forms of warfare. So the rigged seesaw swings between the two parties in the U.S. creates the illusion of democracy, keeping the acceptable politics within the U.S. situated from the center to the far right. That's our political spectrum. In fact, transition occurs. There's an interesting thing that leads to changes in parties. Democrats, usually in line with growing social polarization and frustration in the working class, will make promises. They'll get elected. People will turn out in larger numbers than typical. They'll get elected. They won't follow through on those promises. They'll stab the working class in the back. And then the next election cycle, there'll be a dramatic drop-off in voting, and the Republicans will win. This is really a pattern that is observable. Rising expectations and demoralization. That's the swing that we see. So the last thing, and maybe the most controversial thing, is talking about the Democratic Socialist, the Bernie Sanders campaign, and debates on the left. The Democratic Socialist of America was founded in 1973 as a split from the long declining Socialist Party of America, and it regrouped with some 60s radicals coming out of the Maoist milieu of the Students for Democratic Society. By the conservative turn of the Reagan years, the DSA was envisioned as a realignment strategy to unite left liberals and the remnants of progressive labor to occupy the left wing of the Democratic Party with the hope of taking it over. I will skip over the history except to say that this did not work. In 1982, the DSA had 6,000 members. In 2016, the party had roughly 6,000 members. And at the same time, the Democratic Party moved far, far to the right overall. Nevertheless, within the last 2 years, the Democratic Socialists have grown eightfold, as I mentioned at the beginning of the talk. Most of this growth has come from young people, mostly college students who entered the DSA inspired by the Bernie Sanders campaign. And Bernie Sanders was once a member of the Young Socialists, the Socialist Party. Specifically, the class struggle rhetoric or the class rhetoric of his 2016 campaign. And this is where I usually do my Bernie Sanders impression, but I will spare you for the sake of time. Since then, polls have shown that a majority of those 18 to 35 favor socialism over capitalism. And this sends shivers down the spine of the ruling class. Because this is a country that whose political system has been perfected in armoring itself against and hammering anything remotely resembling socialism. They have lost their young. And not only that, the older people are also moving left. They come from the ranks of the 13 million people who voted for Bernie Sanders, or many of them do, many of them who voted for the first time in 2016. But it's also important to note that while there is broad support for socialist ideas, to be a member of the DSA is to fill out a form online. So the active number of people who are acting on socialist, or what they perceived to be socialist politics is perhaps several thousand at most. But nevertheless, they have been very active on social, and the left, I should say, has been very, which is the new people, have been very active in a variety of different campaigns, the Abolish ICE movement, refugee solidarity, of course, you've probably heard of the Medicare for All, a lot of the campaigns that have come up over the last few years. Furthermore, their grassroots door-knocking efforts have helped get over 20 socialists elected in the United States and across several states and municipalities, the largest representation of self-identified socialists in U.S. politics in a century. They were instrumental, the DSA kind of grassroots base was instrumental in getting the stunning victory of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez over establishment figure Joseph Crowley in Queens, the fourth highest ranking Democrat in the House, was defeated. They did not see that coming. They definitely are preparing to not be fooled again next election cycle. But to their dismay, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has become the most popular politician in the U.S. Well, yeah, surpassing Bernie Sanders. Most recently, like a week ago, a week and a half ago, the six Democratic Socialists were elected in the Chicago City Council there. The city council is the central city government under the mayor, and they joined four others, so now 10 out of 50 city councilors in Chicago, the third largest city in the United States, are open socialists or self-identified socialists, including an ex-ISO member who recently beat out a Democratic Party candidate. In their capacity as socialists, they have been able to project support, or they've been able to project left-wing causes to a larger audience, such as Medicare for All, the Green New Deal, and, like I mentioned, abolishing ICE. Of course, not without contradictions, and I'm sure those will come out in our discussion. So, a recent vote showed the majority of the DSA who voted. Apparently, they're also having voting issues inside the DSA. 12,000 people voted out of the 58,000, or 60,000. 64% voted to openly endorse and run Sanders campaign. And so this is the trajectory that most of the people in the DSA are now on. Now, within that would be the starting point, is the support for Bernie Sanders. There are other perspectives. So I would say those within the DSA, especially on the right and center, are continuing to promote the idea of a realignment strategy, which is the original intention of the DSA, which is the idea of building a left wing of the Democratic Party with the intention of pushing it left with the goal of ultimately taking it over and making it into a social Democratic Party. This is the dominant perspective, embodied in the most overtly in Bernie Sanders' campaign, and also in the campaign of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others. Although Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez distinguishes herself by also taking positions directly against the Democratic Party leadership. An activist wing of this group maintains that social movements in alignment with electoral campaigns can make the Democratic Party into something truly social democratic. A second perspective, which also exists within the Democratic Socialist of America, the left, is what's called the ballot line strategy and the dirty break. These are two different perspectives. The dirty break sees an organized group of socialists moving into the Democratic Party through the DSA, or as independent socialists through the DSA, and moving into the party as a group to ultimately work to consolidate a left that can at some future point break to the left and form an independent party. The ballot line strategy also envisions working within the Democratic Party, but to run independent socialists outside of the party preferences under the Democratic Party line, also to facilitate a kind of polarization between the left and right of the Democratic Party, working towards the goal of a future split into an independent socialist party. This perspective, the ballot line and the dirty break, believes that by remaining outside the party, the left relegates itself, and I'm quoting somebody who said this, who supports this, to trying to build a separate and theoretically pure organization on the outside of the radicalization that is taking place, which according to them is a recipe for isolation and failure to build a socialist movement where it is taking shape, and that is inside the Democratic Party, according to them. Those on the left who reject this have supported either building an alliance, an independent alliance with those within the DSA and those on the left in social movements, while maintaining independence from a party that they characterize, they meaning people like me, as a party let me read. This perspective, largely held by smaller revolutionary socialist groups outside the DSA, see the possibility for building either independently in alignment with the left removing populations, or ultimately building an independent socialist party outside of the Democratic Party. This includes the belief that it's possible to form a new socialist party, but that it cannot in any way be done through the Democratic Party. This includes, for reasons I've laid out, throughout most of this talk, but also including the irreconcilable contradictions of working within an imperialist, anti-immigrant, and anti-union party while simultaneously advocating for anti-imperialism, pro-immigrant, and pro-union politics. It would mean having to conform the party to some degree, especially when it comes to money. Furthermore, resistance to the pull of compromise or negotiation, which we already see playing out in terms of some of the democratic socialists, basically having to play the kind of, in order to get support for this, I have to give support for that, and ultimately co-optation takes place through those mechanisms. This perspective sees the parties itself a creature shaped by a history of resisting socialism and demobilizing movements from below, and therefore, the left would be drawn into those same problems. Nevertheless, as I mentioned, this perspective recognizes the existence and significance of the new socialist movement, which is in large part expressed within the parameters of the party, but not exclusively. This includes large numbers of people who have entered into activism since Trump, who are not entering into the DSA or operating within the framework of the Democratic Party, at least in their own minds. Tens of thousands of workers in the strike wave that has recently rolled across the United States. And the growth of independent left groups and formations critical of the party, including on the socialist left in the last few years. I didn't mention them. But the idea is that there is the potential to build something independent of the Democratic Party around these forces. It will be necessary to build independent movements to not only win reforms, but to push left-wing politicians to fight against the system from within. There's an interesting example of this in which Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez had campaigned on abolishing ICE, was elected in her district around that campaign, and then during a budget debate with Trump, she and other Democratic Socialists actually voted to fund ICE. And so socialist activists outside the Democratic Party and the DSA, including people I work with, worked through her district with groups active within her district, including the DSA, to push for a meeting with her, and her staff. And through that meeting, made an argument that she should not support the funding of ICE under any circumstance, and to follow through with that demand. And for the only person to vote against the funding of ICE in the last cycle of budgets was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So it, you know, showed that there can be, you know, it needs to be forces outside the party pushing against it to get, you know, these people to actually follow through. These parts taken together create an understanding, you know, I think, for the possibility of creating an independent socialist party or moving in that direction in the space of the next few years. The question of the future socialist party cannot escape the question of how to relate to the Democratic Party. I hope this talk laid out some of the dimensions that are facing us today, and I look forward to hearing the